Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're going to be discussing sort of
wine's sort of the theme, but you have to trust us. There is a thread running through this program.
Well, loosely. It's just
loosely, but well, when you start out on the Atlantic coast of Spain, then you duck into the wine country in the state of Oregon in the United States, and then finish up with China and wine.
It's a little hard to put it all together.
This is an adventure for you today. You may be sure that even though you thought you knew everything about wine, you'll pick up something in today's program. So why don't we get underway right away with...
Right. Well, we're going to start off actually with the a product of Spain, which is the Bodegas Oliveras Spanish Vermouth. And it's recently arrived in this country. So let's learn about it.
Hola, Miguel Oliveras. Welcome to On the Menu Radio. We're delighted that you're calling us today, and you're calling us from the southwestern coast of Spain, where I'm sure the weather is more beautiful than it is in the northeastern United States, where we are sitting right now.
Hello. Thank you for calling.
Now, we were intrigued, Miguel, to know that there was this new vermouth coming into the United States. And that it was Spanish, because mainly we associate vermouth with Italy.
Yeah, well, first of all, about the weather. Yeah, our weather is very similar than California.
See,
you know, when I get married, I go to United States for honeymoon.
Uh-huh.
I go for Grand Canyon.
Uh-huh.
I go also for Hawaii.
Wow.
We're in Maui. And for sure, I'm 5 days in the Napa Valley.
Mm-hmm.
Napa and Sonoma.
Beautiful.
Also Russian Valley. And that's beautiful.
And you know, like the Russian
River. We are winemakers. I love all the winemakers around the world. And the weather is very similar than California here.
Good.
About vermouth, yes. Carpano in Italy was the first vermouth producer, but here in the south of Spain, in this area in Huelva, there's an old winery who is closed now, and they produced vermouth 2 centuries ago, 200 years.
Okay, so Miguel, yeah. there is a tradition.
Big tradition.
Of making this rather sweet-edged, fortified wine. That's something that's been going on in your region for, you said, a couple of centuries.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, we were introduced to one of the major grapes that you use in your vermouth is...
Well,
Go ahead.
Yes. We use mainly a local grape, who's called Zalema grape, okay?
Right.
But also use Pedro Ximenez grape. Why Zalema? Because Zalema now is more or less 80% of the vineyards here in Huelva area, in the Condado de Huelva appellation of origin wines. 80% of its vineyards are Zalema grape. And also we use Pedro Ximenez grape because it is a very special sweet grape that is very interesting to produce sweet wines. And our vermouth is produced mainly with the sweet wine.
Now, interestingly, on a previous visit to southern Spain, to Andalusia, someone told us about the grape called Pedro Ximenez, and they said, we think that these grape cuttings came with a German mercenary soldier whose name was Peter Siemens. And somehow
this is part of the history. Part of the history is correct.
Okay, yes. So you agree with that also?
Yeah, but you know, Pedro Ximenez is only produced in the south of Spain, in Andalusia. Why? Well, because we have a lot of sun. And if you want to produce a good Pedro Ximenez, you need it. So it's a very, very traditional here in the south of Spain. If you visit the center or north of Spain, you never see this great variety.
Now we've talked about the grape variety that's specialty of the Huelva region where you're located and the Pedro Jimenez. But one of the secrets of making a great vermouth is the other things you put in the barrel. Tell us a little bit about those components of your vermouth.
Well, Pedro Jimenez and Salema grape. But now, if we compare with a typically Italian vermouth, they produce the vermouth with a 15% white wine alcohol. I mean, the vermouth is 15% of alcohol, okay? But Italians use white wine. We use white wine, but sweet wine with these two great varieties, okay? Salema and Pedro Jimenez, they produce the vermouth with a 15% white wine, but not sweet wine. They add sugar or other components.
Oh.
We have the natural sweet wine with the Pedro Jimenez grape variety. That's the first difference, okay?
Yep.
We don't need to add any sugar or any other edulcorant. You follow me?
Yes.
So, which is the difference also? Well, we produce the sweet wine that we use for the vermouth, and later we put into American oak barrels before to use for the vermouth. Okay?
Yes.
Now, the natural essence of the vermouth, and every winery has different options, okay? We produce our Crianza vermouth with 30 herbs, okay? And we put the herbs into the Holanda. Holanda in Spanish is like Holland in English, and the Holanda is the alcohol that we use for the brandy production.
Got it.
That was unusual. I didn't know about that either.
It's unusual. So it's unusual because, the wine that we use is a natural sweet wine, okay?
Yep.
We don't add any edulcorant, any sugar, and also we use Holanda. So we put the herbs into the Holanda in the old recipes, okay? And we age 2 months the herbs with the Holanda. After 2 months, we press all this juice, and the juice that we obtain is going inside the American oak barrel where we have the 2 years old sweet wine. Good?
Right.
So we mix all together, and we wait time inside. We don't filter, we don't sterilize. It's a natural product without filtering process.
Now, this is what you do at your winery, which is your bodega, which has been now is in its third or fourth generation.
Third.
I'm third generation, but I have 5 children.
Ah.
Yeah. So, son of Ben is going to be the fourth one.
Right.
So,
right. I have to pray
because son of them have to be fourth generation, yes.
Now,
our winery was established in 1940.
Now, are there other bodegas in your area who are also making vermouth?
Yes, there's other bodegas, but mainly we are the famous one now because we are the first producer of vermouth. And also because we have a 8-year-old vermouth, a reserve vermouth, who is very famous here.
Oh wow, that
because
sounds good.
This is included into a French book, who is called the Great Book of Vermouth.
Wow.
And they are the 50 best vermouths of the world, and the Oliveros Reserve vermouth is one of these 50 best vermouths of the world.
Congratulations. That's really something.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Is that available in the U.S.?
No, not now, because, our importer is a lovely importer. They are very, very, well, they are funny people, and they say our vermouth is superb. So we say, okay, try with the Crianza, and later we have to speak about the reserve, you know, because the reserve is reserve vermouth is like a Ferrari, you know, is wow. It's a,
like a Ferrari.
Lovely product. It's a lovely product. It's a lovely product. And but which is the problem? Well, the reserve vermouth is more limited in the production.
Oh,
okay?
Sure.
So it's not the same. For me, we have all the reserve from my grandfather, and we produce the vermouth in the same system that my grandfather 77 years ago. The reserve vermouth, my grandfather never sells outside of the winery. It was a family reserve.
There you go. Okay.
So, yeah. But I speak with my father years and years ago, and I say, hey, Daddy, why don't you we produce the and sell the reserve vermouth? Hey, and he say, oof, be carefully. Maybe people love it, and we have to produce it, and this is very, very slow production. That's really true, no? They are old, very old product, and, you know, we have to wait 8 years with this vermouth. But mainly this year, we can send some vermouth for the United States, but not in a big quantity, you know.
No, I guess not.
Make sure there's a bottle that has our name and address on it, would you?
Okay, yeah. I'm going to write it.
Here's a question. You're exporting your vermouth, the Crianza, into the United States because that's how we found you. And in the United States, sweet vermouth or any vermouth for that matter is used generally in cocktails. The famous ones in the U.S. being the Manhattan, the Americano, and what's the other one? The one with gin, the one with Campari.
Yes. Well, cocktails is a possibility for sure. We sell in Caribbean area for hotels, you know, the all inclusive hotels too much vermouth. But
sure.
This is 2 years old vermouth, okay? And this is a very good vermouth. Sometimes I think, well, it's obviously it's possible to introduce in cocktails, but I prefer to try our vermouth on the rocks.
Yeah,
nothing more.
I was going to ask in Spain, how is vermouth drunk? And you just answered it. It's drunk as an aperitif.
Aperitif. Aperitif.
Sort of a little bit like sherry, but you still you still suggested that you like it on some ice, which I'm sure sherry producers would probably frown upon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I prefer to try on the rocks. You can add something, you know, soda or something like this. But it depends the quality of the vermouth, you know. If you have a young vermouth, maybe, yeah, you can add soda or a touch of Campari or something like that. But, for example, I remember when we speak with wine sellers about our vermouth, and we send the sample, well, and this guy says, hey, this is a lovely product, yes. And I remember I say to Jordan, be careful, this product is very interesting, it's a very good product, but mainly, you have to offer on the rocks, okay? If you put or if you add soda or other products, it's going to be changed, okay?
Uh-huh.
And the quality is quality. If you have something good, you don't need something to accompany. You only need to try in the he is, you know. If this is a lovely product, a lovely vermouth, you have to feel the sweet wine in origin. You have to have the touch of the old American barrel where it's produced. You know, you have to have the touch of the PX, for example, for the Pedro Ximénez, and, well, with other, if you accompany with something more than rocks or ice, poof, it's not the same.
Peter's been experimenting with your vermouth, and he's made Negronis with it, his favorite drink.
Yeah?
And he's made Manhattans with it.
Yeah.
And we sipped it on its own.
Yeah, we sipped it on its own, and it... It's great. It's great everywhere you have it.
I have to learn about you.
Here's the important question, Miguel. How do people around the world figure out where they're going to be able to have access to your vermouth? Is there a single website they can go to, whatever country they are in?
We are now working in a new website. Our English version is we are changing, okay? Because our winery is a familiar winery, okay? My grandfather established it in 1940. And I remember when I was young, now I'm 45 years old, I'm not very old, but when I start 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago in the business, in the familiar business, I remember I speak with my father, hey, daddy, we have to think about outside of Spain because we never export. We export since 2002. Okay, today we are exporting to 18 countries and 85% of the wine production of the company go outside of Spain. In the vermouth, people get a very big surprise with the quality of our vermouth because, our style of vermouth is very different than, it's a little bit different than Italian style because, we use a natural sweet wine to produce the vermouth. So
right.
This is very different. If you don't have a winery in the south of Spain, you can't use, for example, Pedro Ximénez sweet wine because you don't have it.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So, it won't grow, right?
Yeah, it's very, very different. So around the world, in other countries, people is very surprised with the vermouth of Oliveros family. Surprised because of the quality.
Miguel, what is the website?
This is bodegasoliveros.com.
Bodegasoliveros.com.
Today, now we have the English version rebuilding. This company. I remember the president of our appellation of origin. I remember he say my grandfather was a very special man. Was the first to do something different in this area. Also my father, but I remember in the year 2000, this company was the first one to have a website, for example.
Really?
And we have the first website in winery in all this area, in Spanish and English. Today, every year we have to, build a new website, but, facelift, the website. And now we are working on English version.
Now, did you study business? How do you know about all these marketing things?
Well, we study in Seville. Seville is in very near from the our winery. In the highway is 30 minutes, and I study economics and marketing.
Okay, so there you go.
The marketing as we can for the wine business, for the familiar wine business. We have the unique private bottle of this area. 2 years ago, we are 75 years old, and I decided to design in Italy and produce in Italy because Italians, Italians for the design are number one, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we have a private bottle who is called Bordelesa Oliveros.
Uh-huh.
And this is a super bottle who is the unique private bottle of all this area, okay? And, we decide to do that because I want my babies, my children, have something for the history. And his father is working on it, no? And this bottle is, something for my children.
Wow.
For the future, okay?
Wow, yeah.
Well, it's been a wonderful pleasure to talk to you, Miguel. Thank you so much for the story of your beautiful vermouth. Thank you very much for the vermouth itself, which we are greatly enjoying.
And I'm going to give you a secret: is I make a very, very famous wild mushroom soup, and the secret ingredient is 2 tablespoons of sweet Italian vermouth, and I'm going to substitute your Spanish vermouth.
Yeah, to change for Oliveros vermouth.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I enjoy the United States and a lovely country.
So we love Spain. So we love Spain a lot. So anyhow, maybe our paths will cross someday.
Sorry?
I said perhaps our paths may cross someday when we're in Spain.
Yeah, waiting for you, eh?
Okay, Miguel.
Waiting for you, yeah. Okay. Sí. Okay, gracias. Adiós.
Gracias.
Okay, listeners, then don't go away because we'll be right back with a story of mushrooms and truffles as well as wine.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Well, the next guest, actually the whole interview started with a press release about National Soup Month, and we ended up with nothing having to do with
soup.
National Soup Month. But at any rate, the name popped out off the page at me of Joe's Restaurant originally
we thought it was still in Reading. It's only moved like 25 years ago.
I didn't think it was still in Reading.
Oh, okay. Well, they didn't. Well, then you were smarter than
but
me.
But it did move. It moved to Oregon, which is in wine country. There you have the connection.
Got it. And not only that, but wine and truffles, and a mean place for foraging mushrooms too.
Yes, and we're going to talk to Christopher Czarnecki. You know, we're going to be talking here with Christopher Czarnecki. And I said, Chris, what are we talking about? My original conversation with your publicist was National Soup Month. And I said, that's January. We can't possibly get this program together by January. So I put a lot of question marks in my last correspondence to her. But I guess she didn't share that with you, Christopher.
No, I missed it. That's okay. It's always soup month in my world.
Okay. Well, here we are. I mean, I recognize from being in Pennsylvania, your family, starting with your great-grandfather, had, I don't know how I could even describe it, I would say a fairly unlikely restaurant in Reading, in the middle of nowhere in Reading, Pennsylvania, called Joe's, that was really famous for wild mushrooms. Tell us a little bit about this background and then how you transitioned to where you are now, which is Joel Palmer House in Oregon. Let's start with your great-grandfather.
Yeah, my great-grandfather Joe was the first of seven brothers who immigrated to the United States, and he opened Joe's Tavern in Reading, Pennsylvania. It was a Polish part of town, and it was a basic working man's tavern, you know, serving local, you know, Polish food. That's what they knew how to cook to the local guys, you know, working in the factories.
Uh-huh.
It was my grandparents, my grandfather Joe and grandmother Wanda, who were the Francophiles. They were the ones in love with French fine dining. My grandfather was an amateur mycologist. He would identify mushrooms for the local hospitals when a little kid would eat one off the front lawn, and they combined the love of mushroom cooking and wild mushrooms with the French fine dining and turned it from a tavern into a fine dining restaurant. So that's how that transition happened.
Okay.
When my parents took over in the 70s, they decided that they were going to keep the fine dining aspect and keep the focus, of course, on wild mushrooms, but expand their base to include ingredients from all over the world. You know, Mexico, Thailand, Germany, France, whatever suited their fancy. But the other big change that my parents made was, of course, moving the family restaurant from Reading, Pennsylvania, to a little town in Dayton, Oregon. And we get that question all the time. Why did we move? Well, Dayton's in the middle of wine country of Oregon. It's about an hour outside of Portland, about an hour from the coast. It's about 30 minutes from the state capital. So it's really centrally located. in terms of the population center of Oregon. Mm-hmm. And we love it. We're surrounded by vineyards and wine. And well, I'll tell you what, we don't miss the weather in Pennsylvania, that's for sure.
Interestingly enough, we started traveling the Oregon wine country probably 30 years ago at least. And at the time, we observed that one thing was really missing, and that was fine dining opportunities. Now, did your father see the same opportunity, or did he just go because he liked wine, or was he just a stubborn guy and he just felt like going there?
Yes, that's the quick answer. There were a couple very nice restaurants here. The fine dining scene has expanded tremendously in the last 20 years. But the quick answer is yes. There wasn't a lot here at the time, but at the same time, he knew where he wanted to be, and he was going either way.
Well, you know, Peter's always wanted for us to move to Oregon, and I like it a lot, but I don't like all that rain.
You know? Oh, you get used to it. It makes you appreciate the sun so much more.
Yeah, I guess you do. So now, describe the name is Joel. It's a historical figure, right?
Right, yeah. See, when they were moving out here, the original plan was to keep the name Joe's because that was the one with the reputation. But after looking at something like 30 different properties in and out of Portland, the very last property that the realtor showed them was a historic building that had been a vacant residence for almost 20 years. And it was called the Joel Palmer House. It's on the National as well as the State Historic Registries. And it was built by a gentleman named Joel Palmer, who founded the town of Dayton. He had an unsuccessful run for governor. He actually led two different wagon trains out to Oregon. You know, when you go travel, you grab Frommer's Guide or Lonely Planet.
Yeah.
So he used Lewis and Clark's journal as his guidebook to get out here.
That's amazing.
Yeah, he was most notably famous for, notorious, I should say, for being very even-handed with the way he dealt with the local Indian tribes. At a time when most, white Americans here in Oregon wanted to just wipe out the Indians, he was the one that was all about getting them resettled peacefully. So he has a great reputation with local tribes.
So
when we got out here, we renamed the restaurant from Joe's to Joel Palmer, and it's stuck ever since, 20 years now.
Now, your pathway into the Joel Palmer House restaurant hasn't exactly been a straight ride.
Well, I'll be honest. You know, I started in the restaurant business in the third grade, you know, just pouring water tableside, helping in the kitchen as the years went by, becoming a server. But when I graduated high school, I was in no mood to go to college, so I spent my 20-somethings having fun, making bad decisions, often the same thing. And I enlisted in the United States Army in 2002. I spent 2004 in Iraq. And so it was when I came home on leave that my parents said, look, we're making our 5-10-year plan. Do you want to join us in the family business? And I jumped on it. And I can't believe that was 10 years ago already.
Oh, boy. So, describe what the Joel Palmer House restaurant is today.
Well, it's still a historical building, so we've got three small dining rooms that seat up to about 12 people. You know, it's a white tablecloth, fine dining restaurant. We have everything from Maine lobster and foie gras on the menu to, you know, local lamb and, you know, local beef. We still emphasize wild mushrooms and truffles that we hunt ourselves and with friends, family, and staff. And we've got a wine list of over 500 wines, all of which are from Oregon. We've got the largest collection of Oregon wine of any restaurant in the world.
Really? Wow, that's amazing.
I guess if you're in Oregon, why would you get a wine from somewhere else?
Well, that's the thing, too, because a lot of people from all over the world now are coming to visit Oregon to taste wine. And, you know, if you're out wine tasting today, you're going to taste mostly the 2013 vintage, 2014. But Oregon Pinot really shines after a few years of laying down and resting. So the vast majority of the wines we're selling right now are, you know, 2007 to 2012. And people like being able to taste what their wines are going to be like in a few years of resting.
I still have two bottles of 1999 Elk Cove Reserve.
Oh, wow.
Which are going to be drunk carefully.
I hope you're storing them properly. You didn't leave them in the kitchen window still, did you?
They're in an Oregon damp basement.
Oh, good. Good. That's
in, in a room I call the wine cellar, which is where the cigars live, too.
We had a wine industry appreciation party back in November, actually, and we got to open a 3-liter bottle of St. Innocent from 1999. Wow. But it was actually stored upright
in the
dining room.
Oh, no.
I know. So we actually took a video of it. It should still be on Facebook. There were 2 3-liters that we did this to, of the process of getting that cork out of it. And it was, this was a 10-minute long affair. We actually used 2 corkscrews at the same time to gingerly wrestle this thing out of there. But it was already starting to turn to dust. The wine itself was in pretty good shape. Not great, but the other 3-liter that we had of the same age, stored in the same conditions, the cork came right out and it was gorgeous.
Really?
So, you know, it just goes to show, even what's considered proper wine storage isn't always the best. But hey, horizontal, 55 degrees, consistent temperature, 70% humidity, that's what you want. Do not use this as an excuse to keep your wine stored on the windowsill.
It's really funny. You said you're doing a wine dinner at Elk Cove tonight. When we interviewed the young Mr. Campbell, he told us the story of how his father decided to make wine after, I think, he was retiring as a physician. And he reported the story that his mother asked his father just exactly how many bottles of Oregon Pinot Noir wine have you tasted? He said none.
Okay. Oh, well, kind of like my parents moving to Oregon. Sometimes you've just got to take the jump of the leap of faith, right?
We can't wait to take the leap of faith and come out and find out what a great job they all did. I'm sure they did. Now let's talk. Can we talk a little bit? But we should talk a little bit about soup, only because.
Right. Well, I don't know why in the world you were supposed to be talking to us about soup. I mean, do you make wonderful soup or anything?
Well, you know, last month was January Soup Month, and we thought it would be fun to have a little competition, send in recipes. And I'll be honest, our oldest recipe, our oldest dish that's still on the menu, never coming off, is my grandfather's Joe's Wild Mushroom Soup.
I make a killer wild mushroom soup. Mine is a variation on Vincent Price's recipes. You know how old that is.
But you know what? Price, I think scary movies. Scary Halloween theme.
He was a good cook. He's a cookbook. This was in this cookbook. So, but the secret ingredient is sweet Italian vermouth. And it was a joke because it only calls for 2 tablespoons full. And we had no other use for sweet Italian vermouth. And so we'd buy a bottle and it would last 15 years.
Well, it will. Like wine, right?
Yeah.
Well, not opened. But
the funniest.
That's the thing. It's often those unexpected ingredients that add the magic to any dish, right?
Yeah. So what's special about your special mushroom dish?
Well, for one, it's vegetarian. A lot of people swear that, you know, we're using beef stock. But when you cook mushrooms properly, you use what we call the holy trinity of cooking with wild mushrooms. That's soy sauce, sugar, and salt. You pull out flavor and texture and meatiness from the mushroom. And it's a pureed mushroom soup. So we've gotten a lot of converts, people who say, oh, I don't like mushrooms, to try the soup and then fall in love with mushrooms.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah.
It's our gateway drug.
Yeah, well, I don't use cream or anything in mine. I use a lot of onions and butter, though. But
well, butter's an onion. Come on, every great recipe starts with butter.
Exactly. So now, I want to just skip a beat here and truffles. Let's talk about truffles. I must be on a mailing list for Oregon truffles. What is it? There's an association of Oregon truffles.
Well, there are a couple. The Oregon Truffle Festival is still going on.
Uh-huh.
And, well, here's the thing. You're foodies like me. You understand what truffles are. A lot of people haven't had the chance to really appreciate the appeal, the sex appeal even, of what a truffle brings to the table. Too many people's only impression of truffle is the synthetic stuff that they get in the bottle.
That's so awful.
Truffle oil. Yeah, it's too intense. It's overwhelming. And, you know, the worst sin I've ever seen committed was somebody advertised fresh Oregon truffles on a dish, only to then drizzle the fake Italian truffle oil over it.
One of these marketing organizations for Oregon truffles sent me a slew of them, a whole big bunch of them. Mm-hmm. And this was some time ago, and so I'm sure that the industry has evolved. I couldn't even taste, they didn't taste like truffles.
Well, here's the thing, a couple things are true. If truffles aren't ripe, okay, if they haven't fully developed and matured, no, you're not going to get any odor or gas out of them. It's kind of like me saying, here's a bright red, juicy, delicious tomato, and then handing you a tiny little green tomato. Okay, mm-hmm. Truffles need that time to ripen. You might have gotten some unripe truffles. The other thing that's true is that truffles in and of themselves don't have much in the way of taste, okay? It's the gas, it's the odors, the aroma, often infused into other things that make them so much fun and enjoyable, okay? So I don't know what was sent to you, but...
they were little and not very attractive.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. A lot of times truffles are not being stored properly.
Uh-huh.
You know, they'll get ugly and moldy. They need to be kept in a cold, dry environment, preferably surrounded by paper towels to absorb the moisture that they're continuing to give off.
You know, I tried to get – Peter has a favorite first cousin who lives in Tasmania, and I decided that Richard, who grows organic avocados, really needed to grow truffles, you know, inoculate the trees and everything. And he never would go for it. But now Australia is harvesting all these truffles.
Most of them.
That's what's neat is that they figured out years ago how to inoculate tree roots with truffles. Now, it's a pricey procedure. And, of course, you've got to invest not only in the land and the trees, but a significant amount of time.
Yes.
It'll take at least 10 years for them to start to produce.
Exactly.
But it has proven successful.
Yeah, you remember those guys in Tasmania who we think really didn't tell us the truth about what was really going on.
I think they were fakes.
But they had some people from France who said they were teaching them, and I'm pretty sure that any Frenchman who knew anything about truffles the last thing he would want to do is teach somebody else how to do it.
Oh, about truffle hunting, you mean? Or?
No, about how to inoculate trees and take care of them so they produce.
Now, I'll be honest. The secretive side is where to find the truffles out in the wild. But the inoculating of the trees, I've heard rumors of an Italian truffle mafia. I don't know if it's true. And so, sure, I bet they want to corner their own market and not let people grow their own.
Uh-huh.
But if that was true, I think people like Charlie here in Oregon probably would have gotten a knock on the door by some nice guys.
Well, I'll tell you,
we
have enormously funny stories about the Italian truffle hunters and producers. I mean, we could tell you. I mean, that we had one case where the guy was stabbing his own brother in the back.
Well, I mean, these things are $100 a pound sometimes. So, and in a year where there are not a lot coming up because they're wild products, supply and demand, it doesn't always have a pretty side.
Now, Western Australia is doing all right.
One thing we can tell you, there is a producer in Pemberton, Western Australia, and he's producing about 80% of the truffles coming from the Southern Hemisphere, and his stuff is really
wonderful,
terrific.
Yeah.
Really terrific. It's the real deal.
Yeah.
And
that's
sure.
what he that is. I mean, we get all of our truffles locally, which is nice, but I do get those phone calls for people who want to buy them, and I usually don't have enough to sell.
Uh-huh. Now, tell me, where do you get – you said Charlie grows them for you. Is that a neighboring
– No, Charlie Lefebvre is a gentleman from Eugene, Oregon, who is inoculating trees. He runs the Oregon Truffle Festival. He helps people train dogs. My dad's the one who's out in the woods every other day hunting truffles. It's his retirement project. It keeps him out of my kitchen, which is nice. But no, it goes with anybody who wants to go with him, and he could be out there for 2 or 8 hours getting all the truffles we need for the restaurant and producing truffle oil made entirely organically from Oregon truffles. It doesn't have that obnoxious intensity that a lot of the fake stuff has. It's authentic, real truffle oil.
I, I circumvented that horrible chemical thing by getting, I can't remember who the producer is, truffle zest. And it's wonderful. It's, I don't know how they managed to get it, actually. How's it produced? Who was it? Sabatini?
I think it's Sabatini.
Sabatini. And I put it on soft-boiled eggs. It's wonderful.
You can sprinkle it on your cornflakes. Yeah. It's really good.
Oh, yeah. Put on popcorn, you know.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I've done that. But, well, you know, Thomas Keller, who I'm sure you know, when he opened Per Se, and his mm-hmm. opening, and the opening of that whole building complex, that's what he served everybody.
Truffle popcorn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, I mean, it's just the aroma of it drew everybody to his restaurant.
Well, Chris, it's been amazing.
We didn't know what we were talking about. We've been on
we figured we wouldn't have anything to talk to you about because it was
you got me talking about truffles, mushrooms, and wine. Of course, it can't get shut up.
Chris, I wanted to check one thing here. Is do you have like official organized tours and so forth for mushroom hunting and truffle hunting? The people who are going to take a trip to Oregon. A good couple,
you know,
with their wife.
My brother he works with my dad on the truffle hunting. They don't generally take people out because it's often private property. But what my brother does is he does wine tours.
Okay.
And so he can give a lot of great background information on the mushrooms, the truffles, the inside information on the wineries. You can find him at blacktietours.com.
Blacktietours.com. Okay. And again, anybody coming to Oregon should come to your restaurant, Joel Palmer House.
Especially if you like Oregon Pinot and wild mushrooms.
Exactly. Perfect. I'd be happy to live on that probably for the rest of my life.
I do.
Oh, Chris, it's been really fun talking to you. And maybe we'll meet up at some point.
I'm looking forward to it. Let me know when you're in town.
Great. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Listeners, you know you're in trouble when a track's coming up and Anne says, "You do this." But seriously, folks, wine and China are two things that I think in most wine lovers' minds won't go together. Most people who love Chinese food probably don't think they go together very well either. But it turns out they do, and there's a story about it. And Noel Hsu, a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy, no less, and a lover of wine and similar beverages, and he's in that business, decided it was time to write a book about what's going on with wine and China, and we thought it was a fascinating story, so we had to bring it to you. So here's Noel. Welcome to On the Menu Radio, Noel Hsu. Noel Hsu, you have, I think it's fair to say, an interesting background. How many people went through the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and then decided to write a book about Chinese wine?
Yeah, seems quite out there.
These events are obviously closely connected.
Yes, very closely connected. You can obviously see the how the transition happened.
I can. It's very straightforward. So come on, you're going to have to explain it just a little better than that.
Sure. So the whole thing was military was always kind of a passion. Always wanted to be in the military. Went through the Special Forces Combat Divers course. Always wanted to be the best. Working with the best. But the whole thing was in the military, as with any other field, it's kind of a young man's game. No one can ever just stay at the peak forever, right? So
oh sure, I understand.
Transition into something different. And for me, after I kind of had my time, did everything I really wanted to, it was time to just kind of, you know, hang up the cap, hang up the uniform, and pursue other passions. So that kind of transitioned into, which also seems pretty left field, but I first had my exposure into the luxury field and jewelry. I went to GIA, which...
Now, let's go back a couple of steps further than that.
Sure.
You have a Chinese connection. Whether you were born in China, were you born in the United States? Let's get that out of the way to start with.
Sure. I was actually born in the United States, born in Boston.
Okay.
Stayed there for a few years and then moved to New York.
But your family's originally from China?
Originally from China, correct. My dad was from Beijing.
Okay. So now let's get to the part where it gets really confusing.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an obsession with Chinese wine. I think it's fair to say, having read the book, you have something of an obsession with Chinese wine, which seems an unsatisfactory obsession. I said it seems like an unsatisfying obsession to some of the rest of the world, but we're going to dispel that, aren't we? Because you're going to tell us why you're going to tell us why you did this and why we should be interested.
Right. So, I mean, if I delve straight into it, everyone knows, you know, China, you know, just a couple of years previous, people would say a rising superpower, right? I mean, but now I think it's safe to say that they've established themselves on an international global level. The thing with that is wine is, no matter how much they consume, they're the number one consumer of wine now, surpassing France, Italy, Spain, the United States. Still a relatively new phenomenon for them. Wine was not as commonplace at, you know, 20 years ago. Nobody knew what Lafite was. Nobody knew what Petrus was. I mean, just the concept of wine did not exist 20 or so years ago.
Right now, so, yeah, but hold on just a second, because there's a part of the story you missed out.
Which part?
Because historically, going back thousands and thousands and thousands of years, wine was involved with Chinese society. People did grow grapes. They did make wine. They did drink it, and then that sort of stopped, and then it restarted. Yeah. So you're dealing with the restart. Give us just a couple of minutes on the historical aspect of it before we do that.
I mean, historically, wine was consumed by the imperial family. It still wasn't as commonplace as, let's say, wine that was consumed in old England, right? It's a kind of a substitute for water because water wasn't clean enough to be drank.
Got it. Okay.
But in China, we had other forms of alcohol that is more, I'd say, that spans even farther than the wine that we made thousands of years ago. We have baijiu. We have kind of rice wine, right?
Okay,
so they consume more rice wine than they did wine, although they did have wine. The wine and the consumption of alcohol kind of really stopped around the Cultural Revolution of Mao Zedong. Because during that time, Mao had a policy of everyone is equal. There shouldn't be any excess. So everyone should be working in rice fields and paddy fields. Everyone should be farming, and you're supposed to be living a simple life.
Okay, so, got it now. Now I understand.
Correct. So the consumption of alcohol obviously dropped drastically because of this. So you wouldn't be using any of the food that you would eat in order to make alcohol. Alcohol is supposed to be a luxury item, if you will.
Got it.
So after Mao, you have what we can term as the Kissinger era, right? Henry Kissinger was widely known for opening up China and allowing free commerce, allowing Chinese immigrants to come into the United States. And that is kind of a slow process that ultimately bloomed into what we have now.
Okay, so now you have a population which is, they're not exactly big wine drinkers, but they certainly know what's good, and they favor buying what's good, and that's not just true of wine, that's true of a lot of things, I guess. But it's certainly big in the wine game, so the names that are current are the ones you mentioned, like Lafite and Rothschild and all that stuff, all that good stuff.
Yes. That, I think, it started off as imitation, right? So China always had a mentality that whatever is good for the Americans, or you can coin the white person, is good enough for them, right? Anything that white people use must be good because just quality-wise, you know, as compared to China, there's very loose regulations in place. So you have Europe, you have U.S., they're drinking Lafite, they're drinking Petrus, they're drinking Screaming Eagle. So China sees that and they're like, well, if they're drinking that, we want to drink that.
It's interesting. We have a lot of students from Asia who are here in our home city of Pittsburgh studying, and they have an interesting approach to drinking. When they go out to a Chinese restaurant, and there's one particular one that they favor, they don't drink wine, they drink cognac, and they drink very good cognac.
Yeah.
So again, it's this thing of saying, well, I can figure out what the best is, so I'm going to have some of that. And there's a slowly increasing trade in that, right? I mean,
and cognac's made out of grapes as well.
Oh, sure. No, I understand.
So I would say for that, it's become kind of a problem, right? Initially, it wasn't really a problem because you don't understand what to do. You should be copying what other people are doing, right? Just like if you're going to a fancy restaurant, you don't know how to, you know, maneuver through the course, just look at what everyone else is doing, copy it, and you'll get through. However, that has spurred into one of the biggest problems in China, and that the counterfeit industry. The counterfeit industry takes that mentality and believes that profit is what the end goal is, right? So I'm going to make, so like you said, Chinese people love cognac, and they love mixing cognac with green tea, red tea, with Coke, Sprite. And so what is the best cognac known to the general population? Louis XIII. Crystal bottle, each bottle goes for a couple $1,000s. And if I were to make a crystal bottle with fake cognac inside, I mean, I'm saving thousands of dollars, but I'm still selling it at the same price point.
Right now, there is fakery in the wine business too, right? And in fact, we interviewed the author of the book, The Billionaire's Vinegar, which was all about the trade in bogus wine, and apparently that happens a lot in China, inevitably, I suppose.
Yeah.
But the part of the so there are two parts of the story. The first part of the story is that wine was a traditional drink in China, even though you might not have thought that, and relatively recently that stopped, and then it restarted, and importing of the finest wines around the world is part of this copying phenomenon that you mentioned. But the part of your book that grabbed my attention the most was what's happening with the growing of grapes and the making of wine that's actually Chinese. And here is quite a dramatic story. So tell us a little bit about that story.
About kind of what's currently happening.
Yeah, what's happening? What kind of, you know, what is China a place where you can grow grapes? The answer is obviously by what's going on, as you describe it in the book. Yeah. That's obviously true.
Right.
But what does it consist of, and how good is it?
I would have to say currently there are two main big brands in China. One is Great Wall, the other one is Changyu. Many people are saying, oh, is China coming out with, what kind of wine should I be getting from China, right? Because there's this whole hubbub of all these people going in, all these great winemakers going in, investing in land, buying plots of land, growing grapes. And why isn't any great wine coming out of China yet? The reason is it's only recently, right? People have only been going in. So, for instance, you have Moet. Moet just went in at, 2014. So you have to give China they're on the right track to grow great wine, but they're nowhere near the amount of time that they need to invest into the land in order to give out great wine. If you're talking about the soil types or the climate, China is so vast and so diverse that any sort of climate that you can find all around the world, whether it's in France, whether it's in, any parts of Europe or in the United States, I mean, you can find a province in China that mimics that exact same climate soil type. So that's kind of one of the great parts about China and its diversity, in that if you're a winemaker from Cali, I mean, you will find elevated highlands with a lot of sunlight, right? If you're from France, you'll find coastal areas with also lots of sunlight, but also very humid as well. And you can grow any type of grape, Pinot, a Chard, a Cab, Sauvignon. So, I mean, that's just currently the situation now. You just have to give China and all these winemakers some time to get used to it. It's a trial and error, because even though it mimics, it's not the same, right? And even though, let's say, China gets sunlight, it's, the time period differs, because you're all the way halfway across the world. So that's kind of currently a brief summary of what's going on.
Sure. So there's a viticulture issue. So there's a natural possibility to grow good grapes in mm-hmm. China, but yeah. there's a viticulture that has to develop.
It's correct.
I guess decades of practice required to really get to a level where the wines are going to rival the wines that are available around the world, in the market around mm-hmm. the world today. So there's a little bit of catch up to do. Now, I'm particularly interested in this next question, because we are headed to Australia in about 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I think you mentioned in your book that, in fact, a sizable part of the wine that's imported into China is coming from Australia. And mm-hmm. are there similar connections in the viticulture area as well?
Is there similar conditions in China?
Is Penfolds in China? Are they involved in joint ventures, growing grapes and making wine, or is China simply importing wines from Australia because
China
they're good?
Is importing wines from, so popular places right now that you're looking at is Australia, New Zealand, and kind of. So in order to answer this question, I also have to kind of bring back the counterfeit problem, right? Because counterfeiting is so rampant, so much of what is in China that is considered high-end is fake. So for the general population, they don't want to be spending, $2,800 on a bottle of Lafite with a 70-80% chance that it's going to be fake, right? Because they don't have enough knowledge to know whether or not it's fake. So they would rather spend, let's say, $100 in order to buy a bottle of Penfold, knowing that the profit margins for counterfeiters are not that high, and they're still getting quality wine while not compromising the authenticity of it.
Interesting. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, you did something else that's interesting, and it requires careful reading of the entire book. And that's the advice you give to someone who is interested in trading in or making wine with or whatever with people in China. I thought that part was very interesting, but I don't think we want to necessarily give all the secrets away. We want to make sure that people realize that there's a book they need to buy. Mm-hmm. It is called China Through a Glass of Wine. The author, we've just been talking to Noel Hsu, and I think you can already tell, listeners, this man's a real expert. Now, if people want to get in touch with you because they have questions, or perhaps they want to see if they can figure out if there's a combination business relationship that would be useful, how can they get in touch with you, Noel?
They could just visit my website. Noel,
go ahead.
Noel J. Hsu. A J, just a letter J. SHU.com.
No punctuation in there?
No punctuation.
Well, we have an interesting story of an unusual direction for someone from the U.S. Military Academy in recent years here in Pittsburgh, because we have a 6'9", 300-pound ex-Special Forces guy who is starting on the offensive line with the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Oh, wow.
Doing extremely well. But you're on an interesting path too, Noel, and I'm so glad that you joined us today. And we wish you well, and I'm sure that your name will continue to be associated with wine and China, and you must get back in touch as things develop in ways that you think would be interesting to our audience.
Definitely. Thank you for having me on your show.
Okay, Noel, have a great day.
You too.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
So there you have it, a program that's mostly about wine, but not all about wine. We hope you enjoyed it and found it interesting and informative, like we hope you find something interesting and informative every week when you tune in to On the Menu Radio. So you'll join us again same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.